This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Conference 2022, held at Faith Builders from August 7 to 9.
Well, I think it's time to get started. My name is Peter Gertzen, and I teach at Wilkes-Barre Mennonite School in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. It's good to have you all here. Thank you for coming. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for these teachers here and for this time that you have given us. I pray that you would be with us as we seek to build your kingdom. Please help us to be faithful in our work. Help us most of all to honor and exalt you in all of our teaching and to serve our students as well. Please bless our time now. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Oops. This is the interior of an Old Order Mennonite meeting house. Plenty of these. Actually, Kyle, can I give you
some more copies?
No, I have plenty of copies. Okay. Right. But if you could just, if we have some other folks
that sure want in.
Yeah. So this is the interior of an Old Order Mennonite, Old Order Mennonite meeting house. This would be a view from, from the entrance, basically. Here's a view from the side of the room. Have any of you, either in the past or currently, attended a church with this kind of configuration in the interior?
Visiting.
Okay, so a couple of you have. Yeah. I suspect, though, that a majority of us would normally attend a church with a different kind of configuration. Would that be correct? Something more like what we have here right now, right? With rows of people sitting, facing the front of the room, and the speaker is standing there like this, right? Does that sound familiar? Yeah, that's what we're more used to. This at one time would have been the typical configuration for the interior of all Anabaptist church meeting houses. The configuration that is most familiar to most of us is something that was introduced into Mennonite churches. I think in the late 1800s, I believe you might have seen some of that transition in the early 1800s, but it would have mostly been in the late 1800s. So, if you have Mennonite ancestors, 200 years ago, all of them would have attended church in an environment like this. And that transition from something like this to the configuration that most of us are more accustomed to was very controversial in many communities. Actually, before we get to that, though, what differences do you notice about this configuration versus what most of us are accustomed to?
The focal point is the same, but it's a bit less lopsided.
Can you explain that more? I think I see what you mean. Say more about that, though.
Okay, so right now our attention is very much pulled forward toward you as the speaker.
Yeah.
Same there, mm-hmm. But right this configuration kind of tunes out everyone else.
Yeah.
And that one doesn't quite as much.
That's a very good way of expressing it. Yes. So the focal point is the same, but it is emphasized in a different way, isn't it? What else do you notice? That to me is the most outstanding difference, but you might be seeing something else as well.
Well, in our settings, it doesn't have to be, this difference doesn't have to be there. This is on the same level,
mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
The congregants, the front row congregants are very close in proximity to the speaking location, and then there's a congregants looking at each other and surrounding the speakers.
Yes, that's a really good elaboration of the main point. In this church building, everyone is literally on the same level. Quite literally. The place where the speakers are is not elevated. physically. So, as I said, the change from this configuration to something more like this, okay, where in a church building, I, as the speaker, would normally be standing on a platform, or at the very least standing behind a thing that, I don't know, protects me from you or something. yeah, that was a very, very controversial issue in many congregations. Most notoriously at, oh boy, now I'm sorry?
Lichty's,
yes, thank you. That's what I was, yes. Is that where you're from? Yeah. Oh, wow, okay. Yeah.
You know the pulpit story.
You know the story, yes, yes. There was all kinds of skullduggery that happened at Lichty's Mennonite Church in Lancaster County. It's in Lancaster County, correct? Yeah. Anyhow, where there was, like, you know, midnight installations of pulpits and midnight stealings of pulpits and, yes, all kinds of things. yeah, so this is part of the lore to this day, from what I gather. Yeah. Anyhow, Christ-likeness was not greatly on display, I'm afraid. And, you know, in one sense, we can look at that kind of controversy and say, what a stupid thing to argue about, right? But it wasn't based on nothing. It wasn't based on nothing. Now, what I'd like to do now is reconfigure ourselves to something more like this. Okay? So let's go ahead and scoot. I got permission from Mr. Landon here to scoot the desks and the chairs around. So let's do that. Okay, so here we are. Does this feel different? It feels different, doesn't it? Yes. Are we... Okay, before I was going to talk to you, and maybe you would participate, right? Now we're going to have a discussion, aren't we? Right? You feel that. You feel that on some kind of visceral level now. So, I mean, all you have to do is embody these differences in configuration. And you can see that, you know, like, doing stuff at midnight was a really bad way to resolve this issue. But they weren't arguing over nothing, were they? I'm starting with this point. If you have your handout, you might notice I have community first and Jesus second. That's not because Jesus is less important. Quite to the contrary. But I think this is a good starting point for the topic that we have. How do Anabaptists teach history? What does our heritage as Anabaptists have to tell us about teaching history? And I think this is a good way to start, is to look at community a little bit. And to acknowledge that learning is something we do together. It is not something that I, as a teacher, impose upon my students. Also, by the way, now that we're all sitting here like this, and we're going to have a discussion, does something seem kind of incongruous about the PowerPoint presentation and the stuff on the screen and everything? Does that feel quite right, or does it feel weird and awkward?
Well, in this configuration, it feels kind of weird because we have to turn really hard that way to see it. And I think if we were going to go into a true old order type configuration, you'd be about there, right?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. I agree. So, maybe...
As long as you don't have any really good pictures you're foregoing.
Well, maybe we can learn something from conservative Anabaptist reluctance towards technological change. maybe there's something to that. I'm not going to use the PowerPoint anymore. So, community. Learning is something we do together, and it's good for us to bring that concept into our classrooms. Now, most of my classes, I teach with my students sitting in desks in front of me. I stand in front of them. I have a thing to hide behind. So there are some good reasons for that. There are good values embodied in this kind of leveling, There are also some good values embodied in a recognition of authority. But every now and then I do, not real often, but I do literally change the way that my students and I are arranged in the classroom. And it does change things. It does make the class different in some good ways. So as the Anabaptists, we can build on the value that we place in community, and we can practice learning as a community activity. I try not to think of myself as dispensing wisdom unto my students. Instead, I try to think of myself and my students as learning together. And I'm farther down that road than they are. But my students often bring up things that I haven't thought of and guide me towards learning more in ways that I couldn't do on my own. And I think it's most helpful, it's certainly most biblical, and it's most Christ-like to understand my teaching as certainly not being for my sake, and also not the abstract imparting of knowledge upon my students. But it is something that I do to serve my community, to serve my students as individuals, and through them, to bless my entire community. That should be my goal as a teacher. It's certainly not about me, and it's not even about my students as individuals, certainly not not solely or entirely. And it's partly about that too. My students as individuals do have value and importance. But it is about something more than that. It's about our community, and larger than that, it's about the kingdom of God. So my teaching of history, it should not view my students and I as atomized in the pursuit of knowledge. We learn together. And at this point, I think it's good to interrogate the topic a little bit. So how do Anabaptists teach history? We have deadlines for these things as speakers, as presenters here at these events. And my deadline came, and I've been kind of thinking about it, but on the day of the deadline, I hadn't quite landed on a title yet. And so finally, I don't know, probably somewhere around 11 o'clock at night on the day, on the deadline day, then I fired off an email to Matthew Mast, I think, with this title. And of course then, like the next day, I was thinking, boy, should it have been something like, how should Anabaptists teach history? Might that have been better? I mean, that also implies some kind of weird things too. I don't know. Anyway, so how do Anabaptists teach history? I had to think also, to what extent is this even a helpful question? Is Anabaptism the measure of our teaching, or should it be? And what is Anabaptism anyways? What is an Anabaptist? So I want to talk about this for a little bit because it's both central to our history, central to our teaching of history is where are we coming from anyways? We need to be aware of our own perspective. We need a certain amount of self-awareness in our teaching. And it's also, it's an exercise in practicing history as well, to consider what is Anabaptism and what does it mean to teach history as an Anabaptist. Thinking about these questions it helps us to exercise the right kind of thinking about history teaching. So let's talk for a minute about what an Anabaptist is. What do you think an Anabaptist is? Or what is Anabaptism? You can answer the question a couple of different ways. Well, maybe ask it this way. How many of you know who the Munsterites were? Okay, so the Munsterites, most of us know who they were. They were the fanatics who took over the city of Munster in northern Germany. I have to say this very carefully at this point. They had connections to Anabaptism. They practiced adult baptism. They believed a lot of other things that Anabaptists believe, but they, by force, took control of the city of Munster, and their concept of themselves, their self-image, was that they were going to build the kingdom of God there in the city of Munster by controlling government and enforcing correct values and correct beliefs and correct practices, and that this was going to usher in the second coming of Christ. And that the final coming of the kingdom of God was beginning there in Munster. So they were exiling people who refused to be baptized. They were practicing polygamy because, you know, King David did that after all. They were good biblicists. they were doing all kinds of things. Were they Anabaptists?
Do you want to go by etymology?
If
Anabaptist is literally baptized again, they were definitely. But
yeah, and that's exactly the right question to ask. So, on what basis are we forming our definitions? Are we going to look at this etymologically? Excuse me. Yeah. I'm familiar with some people I respect who say no, they weren't. The Munsterites were not Anabaptists, and they're looking at this from a theological perspective.
Yeah.
So, from a theological perspective, Munsterites diverge significantly from other Anabaptists, or people who, like the real Anabaptists, and certainly from us, or at least from me. And so, Jerry, what were we going to say?
We'd probably be better off defining it theologically, like somebody that holds to the points of the Schleyheim Confession, for example, which the Munsterites clearly were not.
Correct, yeah, right.
With the article on the sword, particularly.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and that's, I think that is one good way to think about it, is to ground Anabaptism in something, you know, in this case the Schleyheim Confession. That's a pretty good place to start. Now, we're talking about teaching history right now, so this is my own perspective. As a matter of history, to me, it makes the most sense to say, yep, they were Anabaptists, for sure. Now, if you're going to look at this theologically, you know, that, yeah, there is a good discussion to be had there. But from a historical perspective, you can't deny the connections between the Munsterites and the Swiss Brethren and people like Balthasar Hubmaier and Melchior Hoffman. Melchior Hoffman, Balthasar Hubmaier, and Caspar Schwenkfeld, I like to call the three wise men of Anabaptism. There's a really stupid joke in there that you can look for if you feel like it. But anyways. There were definitely connections between the Munsterites and Melchior Hoffman. Melchior Hoffman baptized Abbe Phillips. I think it was Abbe Phillips. Who baptized Menno Simons. There's a kind of lineage there. Now, I personally, as a matter of history, I think it makes the most sense to define Anabaptism in a way that includes the Munsterites. But Anabaptism then is not a matter of spiritual status. It's not a matter of whether or not someone is faithful to Jesus. It's a matter of heritage and a matter of identity. That's what Anabaptism is.
Is it actually okay to see it that way?
Well, I mean, I obviously think so. I'll say more about that. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm just thinking that I've been gravitating toward that through most of my college years.
Okay.
I was like one of a very small handful of Anabaptists.
Yeah, I'm in the minority here. If I'm going to talk about...
I came back and kept my trap shut because I didn't want to convert at the stake for heresy.
Right, yeah. There's some levels of irony there. I hear what you're saying. And I talk about community and all that stuff. I'm going against the grain of my Anabaptist community where I say, yep, Munsterites, Anabaptists. That's right. Yeah. But once you, the danger to me is once you start trying to define Anabaptism by some kind of theological or spiritual criteria, you end up with a definition that you find in a mirror if you're not awfully careful, you know? if this is the identity that we're going to choose for ourselves, we end up thinking about that in a way that's essentially a reflection of ourselves. And I think that's dangerous. Because if we say that Anabaptism is what is good, and I am an Anabaptist, then I am good, if we're not careful. Uh-huh. And that's not to, I think it is important to talk about what Anabaptism is, theologically, and evaluate it that way. And you can certainly differentiate between Anabaptists on a theological basis. But if we're going to think about Anabaptism as our heritage, that means recognizing some things that aren't good and acknowledging them and trying to learn from them, maybe so that we don't repeat the same mistakes that some of our forebearers made. And yes, there's a sense in which the Munsterites were my forebearers. They are part of the story of my people. I kind of wish they weren't. I certainly don't want to emulate them. My dad likes to say we're all good examples, but we're not all examples of good. And that applies to people like the Munsterites. So are Anabaptist Munsterites, or I'm sorry, I said that backwards. Were the Munsterites Anabaptists? Or what about that Amish guy who cut people's beards? How about him? What about Doug Mastriano? If you're in Pennsylvania, you might know who he is. Or some lesbian Mennonite pastor. You know, it's about heritage and it's about identity. That's my point of view. Are these people faithful? Are they faithful to Jesus Christ? I mean, I don't want to judge people, but I think I can say in certain ways at least, none of these people are. And that's what really matters. So Anabaptism, in the way that I think is most helpful to think about it, especially as a teacher of history, Anabaptism, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble garbling my words here. Anabaptism is a heritage and it's an identity. And there are good things about that. And there are some negative things about Anabaptism as well. And we need to acknowledge those things. And most of all, we need to remember that Anabaptism is not the standard by which we measure what is true and what is good. I don't think Felix Mons and Michael Sattler and Pilgrim Marpeck and Menno Simons would be comfortable with us looking to them as a baseline of truth and goodness and righteousness. Would you want them to? You know? Do you want to look back at, let's just say, Michael Sattler, for example, and would you want him to tell you to look at him? He wouldn't want that for himself, I don't think. I don't think that's the kind of Christian that he was. And somewhat ironically, I think we best honor our Anabaptist heritage when we keep it in perspective, and when we always submit our heritage to Jesus Christ. That is what our Anabaptist forebears would want us to do. Which brings us to the most important point, the second point, which is Jesus Christ. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 11 says, "Other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ." If we are relying on our heritage to establish and maintain our faithfulness as Christians, we are making a terrible mistake. Again, our forebears wouldn't want us to do that. They would be deeply disturbed, I think, if they would see us to be holding them up as our example to follow. I think they would say, like the Apostle Paul did, "Follow me as I follow Christ." Heritage is a dangerous thing because it so easily becomes an idol. And you know, the best idols are things that are good, right? If something isn't good, then it's not going to make a very attractive idol. So none of this is to denigrate our heritage, by no means, unless it is to denigrate it in comparison to our Lord Jesus Christ. But our heritage is something that we can learn from. There are good examples to follow in our heritage. And devotion to Jesus Christ is probably the most valuable part of our heritage. Historically, Anabaptism has been an example of Christocentrism, that'd be the theological term, rather than being centered on the church or even being centered on the Bible. Again, not to denigrate the Bible or the church, but to consider them in relation to Jesus Christ as the Lord of the church and the source of Scripture. And I'm curious if any of you have any ideas just what made me think of 1 Corinthians 3, verse 11. Other foundation can no man lay than that is laid. Yeah?
It was kind of Mina's key verse.
That's exactly right. This is the verse that Menno Simons placed at the beginning of, I think it's accurate to say, all of his writings. Every time Menno Simons published something, he had this verse printed at the beginning of it. And that's a powerful example to us. And this is the greatest and most important thing that we can derive from our heritage, is that Jesus Christ is the foundation of everything that we do. So what does that mean when it comes to teaching history? What does it mean to found our teaching of history on Jesus? It can mean a few things, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about this, but I think it means that we evaluate what is good and what is important about the past by the character and teachings of Jesus Christ. And I'll talk about this quite a bit more later in some specific examples of this. But Jesus is our standard for determining what is good and what is important about the past. But what else do you have to say about that? What does it mean for Jesus to be our foundation as history teachers?
Jesus is the clear testimony that God has a plan to which he's committed for the world, which includes all civilizations and all of the liberal products of what men have done. Jesus came to live among us, and so history matters as a story of God's work among people.
That's a good way of saying it. I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but I think you're right. Yeah, thank you.
I always start my history classes with talking about meta-narrative, because like what that is for a person completely changes how you understand all the stories you look at throughout the year. And so I ought to also connect that to Jesus, in that if the meta-narrative that a student brings to it, that the apex of this grand story is the work of Jesus,
thank you so much.
Then all the other little stories fit into that in a way that they don't otherwise. And kind of that assumption that the world has gone wrong, but not irreparably wrong.
Yep.
In fact, it's being repaired by Jesus, and everything that we study fits into that.
Yeah, thank you. I've been studying history in one way or another for over 30 years now, and it is very deeply depressing. There is a sense in which the more I study history, the more depressing it is. It really is. If I were not a Christian, then studying history would have surely made me a nihilist. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, I'm just paraphrasing this off the top of my head, but if it were not for the hope of the resurrection, then we would be of all men most miserable. And that's true.
Yeah, you know, I look at just the suffering and the death and the destruction that's happened in the past, and you have to acknowledge these things are going to happen in the future too. They might happen to me. They might happen to you. They're going to happen to people that we care about, and that is a deeply depressing prospect. But you have to face that. It's just the truth. And if I didn't believe that Jesus is working in the world, he is working through his people who accomplish beautiful things in the midst of all of this, and he is coming again to establish his kingdom forever, where these things will all be set right. If I didn't have that kind of hope, I would be a very sad, angry man. So he gives meaning to our study of the past in a way that nothing else can or could. Yeah, thank you for those thoughts. What else do you have to say about Jesus as the foundation of our study and teaching of history? Notice, by the way, I like to talk about studying history more than I like to talk about teaching history. if our teaching of history is not the outgrowth of our study, then we're doing something wrong. But anyhow, yeah, what else do you have to say?
I think studying history forces you to choose a side.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two sides. There's, and especially the thing of the Bible. The Bible's a big, long story of two sides fighting. And as you read it, if you read it as a story and with any history, I think it forces you to make a decision, which side am I going to be on?
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to our next point. I think we'll go ahead and move on to that. Truth. We value truth, and there are a couple of ways that I think our devotion to truth should shape our study and teaching of history. First of all, again, I mean, this is just another way of saying the previous point, really. Jesus is the truth, and his word that he's given us is the truth. And these are the standards by which we evaluate history. When, like Micah was saying, we make a judgment about history, which there's a lot of argument among historians about whether or not making judgments about history is appropriate. And there are some good cautions to learn from the side that says that the study of history should be purely descriptive, rather than making value judgments about the past. There's something to learn from that, but at the end of the day, I think we do have to come down on a side. Although I will say this, I tell my students, most of history is not about good versus evil. I mean, it is on a grand scale, but in a more particular way, looking at more isolated events and movements. It's not about good versus evil. It's not about the good guys versus the bad guys. It's usually about the bad guys versus the other bad guys.
Yes.
I mean, really, you know? I mean, really now, you know? So who do you root for in the Hundred Years' War, Britain or France? I mean, you know, you know, occasionally it's about the bad guys versus the even worse guys sometimes. But sometimes it really is good versus evil. Sometimes there really are good guys in the story. But an awful lot of the time, there's not, you know? Again, from the perspective of the revelation of God in Jesus Christ and the Scriptures, that's how we evaluate history. We identify what is good and what is evil and what is true and what is false, according to what God tells us through his Son and through his written word. Our devotion to truth should also lead us to be good practitioners of history. Kind of like being an auto mechanic. Can you be a Christian auto mechanic without being the very best mechanic that you can be when you are evaluated by the standards of auto mechanics? I mean, you could love the Lord as much as you want, but if you don't fix cars, are you a good mechanic? You know? Are you going to be a good mechanic if you reuse oil filters or something like that? You know, because, you know, you can save some money that way or something. I don't know. by the same token, the practice of history does have standards. And there are good and bad ways to study the past. And I find the standards of the professional standards in the history profession to be broadly speaking, compatible with the teachings of God's word and the revelation of his son. So practice good history. What does that mean? First of all, get your facts straight. And getting your facts straight involves rigorous sourcing. Make sure you know where your information is coming from. So to give a couple of examples, when I said, I plan to say this about Menno Simons, excuse me, quoting 1 Corinthians 3 verse 11 in all of his writings, I remembered that. I remembered seeing that before, hearing that before. Is it good enough for me to just tell you that without checking to make sure it's actually true? That's not going to be good enough. You've got to make sure you have your facts straight when you teach history. So I did that. I could have fetched a copy of the complete writings of Menno Simons and looked through it. That would have been the best way, honestly. Did I have time for that? No, I did not. I mean, if I would have, you know, in theory, I could have done that a few days ago or something. Instead, I went to a reliable source. I went to the Global Anabaptist Mennonite Encyclopedia Online, Gameo, which some of you may be familiar with, and which is a very good resource, a reputable source. And I went to the article on Menno Simons, and I did a search for 1 Corinthians 3, verse 11, and sure enough, there it was. And according to that article, then yes, Menno Simons began each of his writings with a quotation of that verse. So I feel pretty confident I'm on solid ground there when I tell you that. I did my homework. I got my facts straight. Another example, I'm going to refer later in this conversation to a quotation from a 20th century French filmmaker named François Truffaut. Probably saying that name wrong. T-R-U-F-F-A-U-T. Does that say Truffaut? I don't know. Anyway. Part of getting your facts straight is recognizing when you don't know something. I love telling my students I don't know something. I love, 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 love it, because that encourages them to recognize their limitations when they see me acknowledge mine. Anyway, so I had this vague memory that some filmmaker once said there's no such thing as an anti-war film. And that's going to be relevant later on to what some things I want to say later. So I had a memory of that. Is it going to be good enough for you just to tell you that? Just to say, someone once said, blah, blah, blah. Is that going to work? Is that going to cut it? Not by the standards of good history. You've got to source it. You've got to find out where this information comes from. So I did that. You know, just some online, you know, internet searching. Yeah, and it's interesting, too. so, you know, I found some, okay, like, I found a... an article on the BBC website, pretty reputable website, actually. And this is a quotation from that article. There's no such thing as an anti-war film is a quote often attributed to the late French filmmaker François Truffaut. You notice how they qualify that? A quote often attributed to. Yeah, okay. It doesn't say that he said that. Does that indicate that maybe this is something that's bandied about without being clearly shown to be 100% accurate? Yeah. This is what gave me the name, by the way. I did not recall the name François Truffaut. I just recalled the general idea of the quotation. Anyway, so that helped me look things up a little bit more. I did find the ultimate source of this information, which is the coolest feeling, by the way. Oh, it's so cool. I just love that feeling when you finally get to the bottom of something. It's what I love about studying history. It's so much fun. So it turns out that in an interview, that was published in an issue of the Chicago Tribune in 1973. François Truffaut said, "I find that violence is very ambiguous in movies. For example, some films claim to be anti-war, but I don't think I've really seen an anti-war film. Every film about war ends up being pro-war." That's the actual quotation. Now, it's not quite as snappy as "there's no such thing as an anti-war film," right? But that's what he actually said. So, I got my facts straight. That's what you need to do also. Do your homework. Do a little bit of digging. And, you know, I recognize we're limited in the time and the energy that we have. You know, we don't have infinite resources. If we were teachers at your average public high school, for example, then we might teach 2 or 3 history classes a day. You know, we might teach 2 classes 5 times or something like that, right? But we're only preparing a couple of classes every day. That's not the reality for any of us, right? You know, you use the resources you have. Go ahead and trust what your textbook says, okay? There are exceptions. But
what if your textbook never ever cites the source, not even in the back?
Most textbooks at the high school level don't. Just roll with it. What else are you going to do, right? Most textbooks are written by professionals who have done their homework. I have seen exceptions. You can always frame that as, you know, to your students when that kind of thing comes up, which I like to talk to my students about sourcing. Make them aware that that the things we think are true come from somewhere. And it's good for students to be aware of that. You can always frame that as, this is what the textbook says. You know, for whatever that's worth. That's good enough. But if you're going to go beyond that at all, as you have opportunity, do your homework. Get your sources. Don't say things just because you heard it one time, or if you do, because in the moment you think of a good anecdote or something. Just say, "I read somewhere one time, I don't remember where, so this might not be totally accurate, but anyways, once I heard," you can frame it that way, that's fine. But it's important for us as a discipline for ourselves as history teachers, and also as an example to our students, to make sure that we give evidence for the things that we portray as facts about the past. Do your homework. Get your facts straight. Gather evidence. Don't say something without evidence. Make sure you know, as best you can, make sure you know where your information is coming from. That's foundational to the practice of history. Also, watch out for bias. Most importantly, your own bias. One of my pet peeves is people who talk a lot about bias and everybody except themselves. And if you're sitting there thinking, like I do most of the time, "Yeah, I know, those people drive me nuts," then you're just like, you're doing the same thing, okay? we all need to recognize our own vulnerability to bias. If your study of history makes you feel good, then you had better beware. You had better start being suspicious. Because the past is not convenient for any of us. It was not assembled to confirm the things that we already think. It is what it is. The past is what it is. Truth is what it is. And it doesn't care about whether or not it's going to support your opinions and beliefs. So be skeptical. Be skeptical of yourself most of all. That's where skepticism needs to start. It needs to start with the examination of my own heart. I can be as skeptical as I can be about everything else, in a healthy way. But if that skepticism doesn't start with me, then I'm going to end up believing and teaching a bunch of stuff that ain't true. So watch out for bias. And along with that, we have to be humble. Our knowledge, our perspective is limited. I had an interesting discussion with my students at the beginning of this school year about what history is. My textbook had a pretty good introduction at the beginning of the book to the study of history. And it talked about sources and evidence. But it and in that way, the definition it gave for history actually to me was kind of curious because of the context that the statement was in. But it defined history as what actually happened in the past, which is an ideal that we should strive for. I think it's more realistic, though, to say that history is the best possible account that we can give of the past. We do the best we can. We are as honest as we can be about the past with the evidence and the resources that we have. But at the end of the day, we have to acknowledge our limitations, the limitations of our knowledge, the limitations of our perspective, our propensity for bias. We have to be upfront about these things and recognize that the account that we give about the past may not correspond exactly to the truth. We do the best we can, but that's an ideal that we strive for while acknowledging that we're probably not going to completely achieve it. So that's the practice of history. It's an important part of acknowledging truth. What are you thinking, though? What do you have to say?
What do you do when you find inaccuracies in your textbook? CLP, 8th grade U.S. history textbook, Section 2 in World War II, somehow paints Finland as an Axis power. It most certainly was not. It may have been an Axis co-belligerent because the Soviet Union attacked them.
Right. That's interesting. I'm teaching that textbook for the first time this year, and I'm enjoying it so far. Does it actually say that that Finland was a member of the Axis?
No, but it,
okay.
But the map that it gives to
okay, this stuff okay,
paints them as an Axis power.
I see. So in the color coding. Okay, because an Axis. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well. Okay. That's a good example. I would. Yeah, what I would say is, and it's important to acknowledge, even when we see something that's wrong, there are usually, maybe not good reasons, but reasons, understandable reasons, okay, reasonable reasons for somebody to be wrong, okay? And in this case, it would be, the warfare between Finland and the Soviet Union simultaneous to the warfare between between the Soviet Union and Germany. And there was a degree of cooperation between Finland and Germany.
Well, they had a degree of cooperation between Finland and the United States.
Yeah, yeah,
too.
Right.
They were flying both American and German aircraft.
Yeah, yeah. So there are reasons why someone making a map of World War II might color code Finland as an Axis power. There are reasons for that. That's not to saying it's correct, but there are reasons for it. So you acknowledge those reasons, but then you say this is at best an oversimplification. So it's not entirely accurate to identify Finland as an Axis power. And here are the reasons why that's not entirely accurate. And crucially, here is the evidence. Here are the sources. Especially if you're going to do something like, say, the textbook's wrong about something, you had better gather your evidence and you had better have your sources ready to point at. So that's how I deal with that. So here are the reasons why I think the textbook says this. They are comprehensible reasons. That was the word I was looking for before. But, you know, there are comprehensible reasons for being wrong. That's not to justify being wrong, but to understand it. Error is not random. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. There are reasons why people are wrong that you can explore and that you can understand. And so having done that, having understood the nature of the error, then we can explain, based on evidence, why we think that a different account of the past is more accurate. So that's how I would approach that. What else do you have to say?
Yeah, I just don't find that I just don't find it comprehensible because the Winter War began largely before the Axis attack and
the German invasion.
So it was basically an attempt to reverse the Treaty of Versailles in the same way that the Soviet Union had already done so in the Baltics.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say boy, we're really getting in the weeds here. I'm sorry.
It's pretty far in the weeds.
Yeah,
Let's just say I have solid reasons.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No. And I think I would tend to agree with your with your final analysis that's not accurate. But we do have to acknowledge the thinking behind the inaccuracy. I think that's an important part of understanding how people are wrong. And that applies more than just errors in textbooks. Whenever we're talking about why people are wrong or when people are wrong, it's important to understand that error. And acknowledge the purposes that people are pursuing, which you can usually identify with on some level. You can understand why people fight wars, okay? On some level, we can identify with the emotions and goals that people have when they begin to fight wars. That doesn't make it right, obviously. There are higher values that we think are more important that lead us to reject that kind of thing. But you can understand it. You can see where it comes from because, we all have some of that inside of us. Thank you for bringing that up, though. Yeah, anything else anybody's thinking right now?
Let me just make a comment on that. Isn't it also true that much of history is not like mathematical or scientific, I just recently had a scenario where I'd say Josephus portrayed a historical figure one way. I think the Bible talks about him in just a different way. He said he's bloodthirsty, and the Bible kind of talks about it a different way. And that's an interpretation of a person's personality. Like, it's not math, And so factually, is something right or wrong? Even they were interpreting it, just like I would interpret, are you outgoing or not outgoing, So I think history also has an element of that is not like maybe factually right or factually wrong always, So I don't know if that mixes into the discussion there somehow. But.
Yeah. It depends on the kind of question you're asking. Was Finland an Axis power? Well, what does it mean to be an Axis power? What does that mean exactly? That's a different kind of question than should Finland have fought a war against the Soviet Union? On what basis are we going to answer that question? Are we going to evaluate that from the biblical standpoint, from the perspective of Finnish leaders at the time and the values that they had, there are different ways to look at that. And sometimes we can, there is a binary, yes, no, true, false, good, bad answer, and sometimes there's not.
And I feel that as an Anabaptist because I think we use a lot of secular textbooks, right? I just read the world different than that. It's not factually disagreeing with the textbook necessarily, but then I would just interpret events differently as a Christian.
Well, let's go ahead and go to our last point, might. This is might as in mighty. 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 and 4 say, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds." I think that an ever salient point of our Anabaptist heritage is what, broadly speaking, our heritage has to tell us about power. And of course, there are exceptions. There's the Munsterites, for example, who had a very different perspective on power than I do, for sure. And taken overall, however, as a whole, our Anabaptist heritage rejects power. The power of this world, the forms of power that, well, like Jesus says, the rulers of the Gentiles exercise dominion over you, but it shall not be so among you. But he that is chief among you, let him be his servant. So we reject violence and other forms of power wielded by the people of this world. Instead, we love and we serve, and if need be, we suffer. And I think it's vitally important to pass this perspective on to our students as we teach history. The example and teaching of Jesus and the apostles shows us that we must reject the kind of power that is exercised in this world. There is another kind of power that is mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. This is not to reject effectiveness or accomplishment, but Jesus teaches us a dramatically different means of accomplishing things than the values that you see in this world. And there are a few ways that I think this should affect our history teaching. I do not believe that we should avoid discussing the exercise of earthly power. You have to, because I have to say this carefully so I don't do the next thing that I'm going to tell you not to do. The exercise of fleshly power is an unavoidable aspect of the past. This stuff actually happened. It's a matter of how do we evaluate these things and what kind of importance do we give them? So just on one level, it's stuff like, who cares about Millard Fillmore? I mean, really? Okay? How many of you don't even know who Millard Fillmore was? Okay? God bless you. Okay? You have not wasted your lives in the ways that some of us may have. Okay, Millard Fillmore was an American president. And I want to say the 1840s, I think. I'm not even totally sure. I should have looked it up. He was an American president, I think in the 1840s, possibly the early 1850s. And I had a textbook once that I used that I mostly liked, but this high school U.S. history textbook, it dutifully had at least a section on every single last U.S. presidential administration. Okay, so if you're just going to go marching through the textbook, then you're going to spend like at least half a class period teaching your students about what Millard Fillmore did. Okay, I mean, really though, who really cares? But doesn't that say something? Doesn't that reveal something about the perspective of the textbook writers on power? They thought Millard Fillmore was important because he was the president, and presidents are important. I say presidents are overrated. The presidency as an institution is one of the more overrated things that there is on this earth. The only reason it's elevated so highly is because people believe in power, and the presidency is a powerful office in a fleshly way. But does Jesus teach us to put that kind of importance on power? Jesus teaches us to reject that kind of power. And again, not that we determine not to acknowledge the reality of this power, but we do not venerate it. And when it comes right down to it, Millard Fillmore didn't amount to a whole lot. Even though he was president, I'd have a hard time telling you a single thing that he did. Okay? The only thing I can remember about Millard Fillmore, other than some of the basic facts of his life, you know, that like he was vice president under Zachary Taylor, and then Zachary Taylor died in office because he got food poisoning, which that's a funny story, but anyway. and then Millard Fillmore was president, and then he wasn't president, and he eventually ran again as the candidate of the Know Nothing Party. But anyhow. And the thing about the Know-Nothing Party is they were opposed to immigrants and Masons. That was their big thing. And anyways, does any of that matter? Don't waste your time telling your students about Millard Fillmore, okay? You have better things to do. In an ideal world, maybe, then, you know, our students will all have encyclopedic knowledge of American history, and they could just go ahead and tell you everything about Millard Fillmore, because why not? You know, it's part of the story of the country where we live. But we're limited in our resources, aren't we? Do you really have time to tell your students about Millard Fillmore? Come on. You have more important things to talk about. Power is not that important. It's just not. Especially if we're going to take the perspective of Jesus on power, we're going to reject the elevation of power in that way. Or something that truly was consequential, like the Battle of Tours. The Battle of Tours in the mid-700s, when the French leader Charles Martel defeated a Muslim army. And that turned out to be the extent of the military advance of Muslims in Europe. So, was the Battle of Tours actually kind of a big deal? It probably kind of was. Historians actually argue about that. But anyways. But according to at least some credible interpretations of history, the Battle of Tours is very important, because that's as far as Muslim army has ever got in Europe. But how are we going to interpret that? What exactly did Charles Martel accomplish by defeating this Muslim army? Now, some people will tell you that Charles Martel saved Christianity, because if Muslims had won the Battle of Tours, perhaps they would have continued advancing. Perhaps the whole of the European continent would have been incorporated into the Muslim Empire. Would that have been the end of the Christian church? Some people seem to think so. And there's a sense in which, you know, once again, going back to what I was saying before, there's a sense in which you can understand their perspective. It's not, you know, I think it's wrong personally. I'll go ahead and tell you that. But I think it's wrong. I don't think it's insane. There are reasons why people think that. There is a sense in which Christianity flourished in Europe in a way that it did not in Muslim-controlled territories. But as Christians, I'll just go and be more specific. As Anabaptists, in the way that we understand the teaching of Jesus in the New Testament, is warfare the means by which we preserve the church? Is that the right kind of perspective to have? At the very least, if we're going to say that the church was preserved by this military victory, is there at the very least going to be some cognitive dissonance there in that kind of perspective and a look at the teachings of Jesus Christ? There has to be some of that at the very least. And you know, I think it is much more faithful to the teachings of Jesus to say that God would have preserved his church regardless. And, you know, if you look at the history of Muslim-controlled territories, generally speaking, there have always been Christian churches in Muslim-controlled territories. There have been some Muslim governments that have persecuted Christianity essentially out of existence in the territories that they controlled, certainly. And that's not something I want to downplay. But it is a fact that, generally speaking, Christian churches have existed under Muslim political domination. Even from just a practice good history, you know, look for evidence, all that stuff perspective, like we were talking about earlier, you have to at least question, to put it mildly, whether a Muslim victory at the Battle of Tours would have destroyed the Christian church. But on a deeper level, maybe we can acknowledge that as God's sovereign preservation of his people on some level. I think that's a possibility. But that doesn't make it good. God's people do not war after the flesh. And we should not elevate the use of violence against Muslims in the Battle of Tours as doing God's work. And that brings us to the quotation from François Truffaut that I referred to earlier, which is paraphrased as, "There's no such thing as an anti-war film." The use of violence is a fact of history. It's something that we will study. But we have to be careful not to glorify violence to our students. What I understand Truffaut is saying is that war looks cool. It does. It just does. War looks cool. So it's impossible to portray war on film in a way that's not going to leave some kind of positive impression, even if you intend otherwise. Even if your intent is to say something negative about war, if you're going to portray it, it's going to look cool. And that's something that we have to watch out for. The use of power looks cool. It appeals to something deep inside of us. And, you know, again, we can't avoid these things. This is part of teaching history. Part of a truthful account of the past is to acknowledge the role that power has played. But we always have to be comparing the use of power to the witness of Jesus Christ and his commands to us as his followers to act in a different way in the world. I'm not real big on blow-by-blow accounts of battles, for example. That's one way I apply this in my classroom. You know, for one thing, you know, kind of back to talking about Millard Fillmore, do we really have the time to give a blow-by-blow account of the Battle of Gettysburg? You know, I mean, I actually think that's kind of interesting. Okay, so, you know, so this regiment went here and they were up in the ridge and then there's, you know, that's kind of interesting. But it's too interesting in a way, right? You know, it makes war look cool. And, you know, and not that there is not a place to study these events. I'm not saying you definitely don't do that. But do you prioritize it? I don't think you prioritize it. Yeah, you just have to be careful as a teacher of history. You have to maintain a Christ-centered perspective on what the use of power looks like in a fleshly sense. Well, that's all I have. And, oh boy, I've overshot my... I apologize for taking more of your time than I should have. Thank you all for your patience. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up? Well, first off, you could have left anytime you wanted. The door wasn't locked or anything. So you're free to go. Anything else you'd like to bring up?
How often do you give certain, like, two sides of an argument, the way people interpret history, and then don't give a definite answer to yourself as a teacher for your students?
That's a good question. I'm a little too self-important to keep from telling my students what I think. Eventually. That's an interesting question. I would have to think about that. Yeah, I think there is definitely a time for that. Yeah, do you have any more thoughts about that?
What if you don't have an opinion yet?
Yeah.
In response to your question, I think that if you can maybe more genuinely give two sides, if you're not just doing it as a rhetorical device to make students kind of want to know what you think. I find my students, if they come out of that often wanting to know what I think, and it can kind of feed that self-importance. But there have been usually I will choose to spend a lot of time talking about something I don't know. Yeah. But I think that can be a healthy learning experience, especially when the student brings it up, and to actually like let them know that I'm not sure here, but here's how we could go about thinking about it. And that's something I don't often do while planning, but I think you're saying something that I aspire to in my history teaching.
You know, one more thing I'll say quick. yes, especially in the last point here. And this is something I struggle with as a history teacher, is you can easily end up giving a very negative account of the past. You know, especially if you're going to be comparing it to the example of Jesus. And you know, sometimes that it just is what it is. But this is something I really want to grow in my history teaching, is to place more emphasis on the positive examples that there are. You know, these are some times when people did something good. One good example of that, I think, is William Penn. Now, William Penn wasn't perfect. I don't approve of every single thing he ever did. But, broadly speaking, William Penn was a good man who did reject the use of power in the way that most people exercised it. You know, even as he established a government in Pennsylvania and things like that, his emphasis was not on exercising power, but it was more on cooperation. The way that he showed respect for Native Americans and attempted to treat them with justice, he is a positive example, and something I want to continue to grow in is to emphasize more of those examples where people, especially Christians, but not necessarily limited to Christians, have done what is right and have been examples of righteousness. And examples of the kind of spiritual power that God gives us and calls us to exercise to demolish strongholds, like it talks about in 2 Corinthians 10.
All right, I have a question that maybe we can't discuss now just for sake of time, but just to throw it out there, like I'm wondering, okay, as far as history, you were talking about not making war look appealing or good. If a textbook does go into detail of battles or wars, how exactly can you teach in a way that makes war look terrible? Because I think it should look awful to us.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah.
Especially when the tests go beyond the textbook and you have to use the textbook.
Yeah, well, that's an argument in favor of making your own test. Which, I mean, I know that's not possible for all of us. Yeah, that is a good question. In my experience, students don't always pay attention to the textbook anyways, which can be a blessing sometimes. At the very least, you know, offer an alternate perspective. You know, that is our job as a teacher. One of the things I learned when I was a student here at Faith Builders was textbooks are not our curriculum. We are the curriculum. We determine what our students are going to learn. And the textbook is a tool.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769. Recordings from past events are also available at www.thedocforlearning.com.